on a Thursday. Angry music calls for angry people. Joining me, the angriest person I know, Jeff Kenny. Jeff, what's up?
Everything's going good, Zach. How are you?
Oh, now you're going to be Mr. Sunshine?
All right. Well, what choice do you leave me? I must tamp down my natural, you know, effects.
Not as angry, but certainly emotional. Tim Lynch joins us. Timmy,
I'm fine, Mac. How are you, buddy?
I'm all right. Tim's bothered that he's gotten emotional in his old age. Why does that bother you?
It's irritating as shit. That's why. And it just is. There are certain topics that as soon as we start treading near, I start for some reason I'm unable to maintain a steady timber in my voice, if you will. And I find it annoying like you would not believe. I hate it.
What a baby. It doesn't bother me. I get emotional about shit all. I mean,
all three of us do.
I call it my trauma menstrual cycle.
Right.
And I can't predict it. I don't know when it's going to happen. I wish I could. But my gunny told me there's nothing wrong with me, so I don't give a fuck what people think. And if I get emotional, then I get emotional. But you seem to be really bothered by it. And is there something you want to tell us? I mean, you want to burden yourself?
No. The only reason I mentioned it is I listened to you talking with Vito, Will Constantini, yesterday. Well, I listened to him today, you know, and I love Will, and my guy, and what a great hour of radio! It's talk about deconstructing the news. It's like you two were professionals, like you're like listening to No Agenda, you know, like the pros. So I was enjoying the hell of it, and then you went into Will's unfortunate story, which of course we know, as our listeners know, he lost his wife last year. And he went through what he explained what he's gone through in great detail with great tenderness and no damn emotion. And I'm like, oh, come on, man. No, this isn't fair. Cause when I do it, I get all, no, I just, I'm like, God damn it. So that's my only comment.
So Will being relatively even keeled about it bothered you, yeah, because you compared and contrasted that with you, and where you become, you know, kind of a little bit of an emotional person.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's right. You know, you don't want to make these comparisons. You're not supposed to make these comparisons, but I do. I mean, it doesn't matter. I don't care what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. Did I enjoy
listening to him though? Fucking Will. It was awesome. Awesome hour.
No, we again, and we've all known each other since about 1990, when, you know, I got to the basic school in 89, and these guys all followed me there, but it's fun, and Will, everybody who listened to it or now that is going to, he's like Jeff, he's like Tim, in that except he's a little bit, he's the most caustic out of all of us. Even Jeff, he's more caustic than Jeff. Okay. Jeff has a jovial side to him, right? Who could, you know, Jeff at times can pass for Burl Ives or Santa Claus on occasion, right? Will never. Will is like Mr. Caustic, right? But he's smarter than shit, right?
Yeah, he is.
He's smarter than shit. And he will give you this stiletto quickly.
Yeah, he was. He was my XO in 1988 when I was a second lieutenant in Lima 3-8, and I was with him for like a year and a half after that. You know, did a mute float and everything. He was making the other two lieutenants call him sir until I got there, and that shit ended quick. I'm like, whoa, whoa. That ain't the way they do it in the fleet that I remember, you know. But yeah.
No, he was just
who the fuck asked you your opinion?
That troublemaker Kenny, come here. Why are you sharpening your K-bar, sir? Well, you listen to it, you know, Timmy. What out of everything that, you know, Will discussed, and whether it was losing Carrie. And Carrie had a huge internet footprint, all the different, you know, things she got involved in. And speaking of caustic and having a flamethrower, you get on Carrie's bad side. There's no question about that. The what about the interview? Anything about it that stood out?
Yeah, there was. It was the reaching out part. First off, he thanked everybody who sent him sent him cards and whatnot of condolences, which was very thoughtful. He actually wrote back, probably each and every one of them. I know he wrote me back, but he talked about the importance of connecting and staying connected to people, as well as self-discipline. And we know Will. He's always been super self-disciplined, but he's in a hard space. You know, he's in a house that he owns, but it's in a place that he's not from, near a job that he no longer has. He's not, you know, he's in a very difficult place, and he's borne it with grace and dignity. And I'd like to hear more of him, because I just enjoyed the hell out of listening to him, because he's a sharp cookie, man, and he's very calm and deliberate and talking on the radio, which is not like me or Jeff.
No, when he sticks this right. When he sticks the stiletto in you, he doesn't even change the tone of his voice.
And, oh no!
And all of a sudden you're like, "Do I have a stiletto in me? Did he just gut me?" And like, "Yeah, he did." Were you not paying attention?
We were aggressing them on their Macress or their True Extra or whatever. It was when it was when Alan was his battalion commander. He had the Met Company.
I evaluated his company during that. Yeah. Will destroyed the enemy, man. You know what he did? He caught him. And I know Timmy's familiar with Lejeune, but Mac isn't. But, you know, the whole thing at Lejeune, Mac, is all about when you're coming from ship to shore, where's the crossings over the civilian highway that AAVs and tanks can use? And Will, he was a master at that. And he trapped a whole company, asshole of belly button, in AAVs with one tank in front and one in back. He just wiped them out, man. You know, it was like, and the guy was somebody we know who's a company commander. I'm trying to remember his name. But I was the evaluator, you know. And let me tell you, it wasn't easy, because when they had hit the beach, for some reason or there's a fuck up and they were floating for like over 2 hours. So when he hit the beach, he had heat cases already. They had them laid out. So he had like a triage going on of heat exhaustion dudes. And at the same time, he was running this fight, you know, as a captain, and he destroyed the enemy. It was incredible. You know, there's like the tank trails that run parallel to Sneed's Ferry Road. That's where he did it. Over there by, well, okay. I know Timmy knows what I'm talking about, but it was masterful.
No, man, I was the enemy. He was fighting us. He was fighting 1-8, and we had just gotten back from Okinawa,
yeah,
so we had maybe 100 Marines in the field, right? And I was a 3. I pulled the battalion headquarters back into the mangrove swamps where the damn red-headed woodpecker nesting area was, thinking Vito couldn't get at me, because I know he's going to go tearing up and we're going to come in behind him. But he knew where I was because he DF'd me. He comes crashing on through, and I'm just I'm sitting there, and he pulls up in his AAV, looks down, and goes, "You, sir, are captured." I'm like, "You're not even supposed to be here, dude. You're in the woodpecker area." He goes, "Oh, fuck." And he's like, "Oh, fuck you." He was all tired and disgusted. He just looked at me and just drove off. It was hysterical.
No, the part of the interview, Will lost his wife, right? And then, all these people reach out to include people that he worked with. And then 9 months later, they let him go, right?
Yeah.
And, when you look at any index of traumatic events in life, at the top of them is losing a spouse or a child, and not too far down the list is being fired from your job when you're the principal wage earner, right? That's a lot in a year. And so
it's
to me,
huge.
Yeah, it was real interesting. And one of the points he drove home was, and it's one of the things we talk about in post-traumatic winning, and that is taking care of your money. You know, to take care of your money, because, you know, when you, and Will's got multiple combat tours, you know, and so you lose your wife, you have that stuff going on inside your head, and now you lose your job. And, you know, the thing that provided balance in his life was that he had taken care of things financially, and so he could live on his house was paid off. He could live on his retirement, and he's okay, and he's going to be okay. And so, I mean, you know, we talk a lot about that kind of stuff, and Will's, a living example of post-traumatic winning. And that the things that we preach that give you breathing space, right, so you're not losing your fucking mind, you know, Will did. You know, Will did. And so, no, I'm, you know, he's one of our friends and you know, really proud of him. He's doing good. And you know, and no, if you haven't heard the interview, you know, it's you'll see it. Will Costantini and a great guy. Jeff, any other thoughts about any of that stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so much to say about him. Like, he's the one who got me to TBS. I was originally supposed to go to, you remember Craig Tucker?
Yeah.
He was going to be the Camp David guy, and he wanted me to be his XO. He was another company commander in our battalion. And, I mean, it looked like it was going to happen. And then they said, the rule is the CO and the XO got to be staggered, you know? So Will got me up there. I don't know how he did it. I think he talked to the XO of the school then, and he's the one who got me to TBS. And then I'm in TBS, and I first get there, and I'm in, like, basic events, or I can't remember what we called it. It was like, you know, it was I was in there for about a week, and then he got me pulled in there. Yeah, he got me pulled in the EI company, which was great. You know, I was a weapons platoon, and I think it's what it really helped me get to IOC, because right. I was, you know, he said, look, at the main effort for our for EI company is support of IOC. I mean, I'm not going to say that publicly, but it is, because that's, you know, and of course, you know, the EIs, especially weapons platoon guys, did all the nitinoid training as far as mortars and machine guns and you know, anti-tank stuff and everything. So I was always being, you know, foisted upon ranges with you guys, Adam, you know?
Right. No, I mean, that's how I met Jeff as the I company. And, you know, we worked so closely with those guys. It is a great way, you know, at the time of getting to IOC, because you got exposure, you got to know those guys, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we need to get him up here at some point. So no, Will's, I mean, he's, you know, when General Kelly's son was killed, in Afghanistan, when Robert was killed, I was in, you know, we were just south of them, and, you know, both my sons went to the funeral, John and Patrick went to the funeral, and they stayed with Will and Carrie and their family. And Will, you know, I sent him an email. I said, hey man, is there any way that you could put my kids? He said, yeah. He said, when do they land? We'll go get them and we'll make sure they get to everything. And not a problem. And they're, you know, obviously great people. So the Timmy's got some COVID-19 thoughts. So we figured we
Timmy has COVID-19, just as I suspected.
No. I wish I could claim this was an original thought, but it's not. But what had occurred to several people that have written about this recently is the numbers that we're dealing with. The COVID-19 numbers we know are now suspect. They got adjusted down to 32,000. And when that happened, it was explained as, well, you know, with this flu count, when we say there's 61,000 dead of flu a year, there isn't really 61,000 dead. That's an algorithm run off of Linux, probably using COBOL code or something like that. And it occurred to me that the entire discussion we've been having, where we've been comparing COVID-19 deaths to flu deaths, if there were 61,000 flu deaths a year in 2017, 2018, and there's consistently every year tens of thousands, how many people do you know that have died of flu? Or how many people do you know who have been hospitalized of flu? In my entire life, I know of one, an infant, and that was actually recently. But that's the only person I know. Whereas car accidents, which account for 36,000 to 40,000 deaths a year, we all know somebody who's been involved in a car accident or has been left their lives in a car accident. I know several. And that's a less frequent occurrence annually than annual flu deaths. So the entire foundation on which we're even evaluating the seriousness or lack thereof of this COVID-19 thing, it's built on a foundation of sand, and I am beyond frustrated at trying to I don't know how this is all going to shake out without a significant damage to the reputation of our elites who are running the system. I mean, this system, because this is what's happening to us. I hate to use the word not fair, but it's not the impact is being felt disproportionately amongst segments of the population who have nothing to do with the cause and effect of this thing. The small businessman, my barber, who in an act of revolutionary defiance, opened his shop so he could cut hair yesterday. I needed money and I went as soon as he opened up to get my hair cut because I'm supporting him. I love that kind of stuff. That's American spirit in my mind. But there are people who honestly believe if we lift these restrictions, a great plague will wipe across the land and kill tens of thousands. And I don't understand how that's possible to think that way unless you spend all your time watching CNN, in which case that makes all the sense in the world. And that's the other problem, is the division within the country over this shit. And that's just an observation I wanted to make, followed by the other observation, which is no matter what steps the states have taken, the outcome seems like it's going to be pretty much the same. It doesn't matter what steps were taken and when they were taken, a point I made last week. It doesn't matter. The results seem to be, and given increased time, are going to be remarkably the same, which means that somehow us humans could really friggin' find a way to blunt the impact of Mother Nature's virus, which is, I think, a lesson as old as mankind. I mean, there's a lot to this we don't understand, and we're acting as if we do understand it and making decisions, and we're ruining people. And I'm beyond frustrated.
I agree.
Yep. Jeff, would you care to comment on what Tim said, or would you care to? I mean, because we have been talking about the COVID thing, so I figured.
I would second what Tim says, except to also point out that thanks to him, that barber will probably be in jail next to that hairdresser from Dallas now. But you know, because that's how they roll in Texas.
In Texas.
But the other. Actually, it's worse where I am, where we are, Mac, in California, as you know. The other thing that counter to that is the ease at which all these government or these state and local elected officials have gone overboard, you know, with restriction of Bill of Rights infringements, in my opinion, and the ease with which most people put up with it. And I think you're starting to see pushback now. But I'll tell you, it doesn't say in the Constitution this stuff goes out the window if people start getting sick. And in my opinion, even if you count up, even though there seems to be an inflation of death, I think, by coronavirus, in the reporting, it doesn't justify these, draconian measures that are going to destroy our economy. And not only that, watching these doctors who pop up on the internet, pop up on YouTube and everything, and then they get shut down. They're making sense, and they're making these amateurish little presentations where they say, "Hey, look, this doesn't make sense to wear a mask after you've been through all this stuff to lessen the effect of this thing. This whole national strategy is senseless. It doesn't really have anything to do with stopping the virus. And this is all kind of like." Suspicious to me, so I can, and when Timmy says stuff like that, I just lap it up,
To me, first of all, I think that most Americans are now bristling over, okay, this has now gotten stupid. Okay. Right. It doesn't make sense anymore. And here locally at 7 o'clock at night on KTLA, Drew Pinsky, Dr. Drew that started on MTV.
Oh yeah.
That dude comes out, and you should hear him just rip the state of California and the governor.
Yeah.
This doesn't make sense. I don't get what they're doing. And so that kind of been interesting. So, and then the other thing is the reaction to when that woman was jailed in, is it Dallas, Timmy?
Dallas, yeah, it was yeah. Dallas. Yeah.
It's almost like the whole, it's like, when I saw that, I couldn't believe it. There, she's going to jail for this shit. Right. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of like what New York has that, you know, they release everybody. And now this woman's going to go to jail for 7 days. Right. 7 days because she says, look, I've got to feed my family. And, you know, which is
she wouldn't apologize, Mac. Right. That was the main reason.
Right. And so and so you're starting to watch that. And I think that I don't know if there's going to be a tipping point here pretty soon where people are going to say, let her out of jail now. And we're going to come down there and there's going to be trouble. And so to me, you know, you can feel it, you know, chafing a little bit. And, right. But the biggest thing I've learned in the last week is kind of read about Sweden and different things I've read about them. They use the word sustainable. And they said, what virtually everybody else has done is not sustainable. We tried to take an approach that we could use that would be sustainable. And they were very critical of themselves, saying that we did not do enough to protect, you know, the elderly in Sweden. And as a result, our death rates, you know, in our the number of fatalities in our long-term care facilities for elderly, in our senior center living, you know, homes, are terrible, and we're not happy with that, and we're not happy with our performance. But everything else, we believe in Stockholm will have herd immunity by the end of the month. And so, they said that wasn't our objective, but that will be a byproduct. And so whether you vaccinate or you allow it to wash through the population, that's your goal, to get herd immunity. So we think that, so to me, the whole idea of sustainability, right? Sustainability. And I look at like the restaurant business. The restaurant business has like a 5 to 10% profit margin. If we cut their revenue by 30%, can they cut costs by 30% to maintain that profit revenue? Or does that mean, you know, if you call out a third to half the tables in a restaurant, I can't open because I still have fixed costs in terms of my rent, my insurance, right? And all the other things I have to pay. It doesn't pay for me to be open. So to me, that those words sustainability and the economic pain that's going to roll through the nation.
Right. You're right. You know, the restaurant business is a canary in a coal mine type industry. You know, I mean, except for that, they last a long time, even when things are bad. But to go after them is like basically digging into the bone structure of our economy, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the problems with the food production downstream too, as far as meat and poultry go. I mean, this is, we don't know what the reckoning is going to be yet, but I don't think it's going to be pleasant.
The, I change gears again. I've done the last 4 weeks now, I've done interviews about Contien and Operation Buffalo. A couple of them, you know, two specifically dealt with that day, one Bravo company, one Alpha company. Right. Timmy, we'll start with you. Thoughts on those interviews? I mean, we're all Vietnam, you know, or readers. And what's interesting to me is, you know, I had not heard or read a whole lot about Contien when I started getting interested in it.
Right.
And which is odd given the ferocity of the fighting that went on up there. Yeah. Tim, you've listened to the interviews, your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I've listened to the interviews. I've read a lot about it. I'm an alumni of 1-9. That was my first battalion when I was a lieutenant, proud alumni of 1-9. I've enjoyed the shit out of those interviews, and I've learned a few things that I didn't know. I have never heard reports of North Vietnamese putting on Marine body armor and helmets and trying to use that to infiltrate into lines. I know that they have tagged on to the end of patrols and tried to walk in, and that was a common tactic. But I've never heard of so many of them putting on Marine uniforms, and that was surprising. The other thing was is that your guy that you had on today, and let me just real quick – Ray Linebaugh. He mentioned killing Chinese. The only person I've ever heard that talked about that was my dad, who said they killed a slew of them up there at the DMZ and couldn't get anybody back at division to believe that they were killing Chinese. In my dad's case, in the Chinacom PLA uniforms. So that was interesting to hear about that. And my final observation is, when we were going through the Vietnam War series, I wrote a post about that battle, because I knew that after Bravo had been ambushed, that they went back out and tore up an NVA battalion, if not more.
No, it wasn't Bravo. It was Alpha. Alpha went back.
It was Alpha, right? No, that's what I meant. I knew that 1-9 did. It was Alpha. Right. But the way that it was, that I read it in the histories that I use, and the way that the company commander, and this isn't fair to the audience because this is something that Max sent to Jeff and I, a letter from the company commander describing that fight, which you'll hear about next week. I'd never heard that. And his letter sounded more authentic. And that's one of those things that makes you that makes you really want to dig into history, is I thought I had an understanding of that sequence of that battle because I personally am involved, being a 1-9 guy. I mean, I've studied it. And I was wrong. I was wrong about the 6-7 July and what that captain wrote and what I believe Ray's going to tell you next week. I think that's going to be a closer approximation to the truth. And again, a testament to friggin' Marines and how hard they are. That's like the equivalent of the tin can sailors. That's like turning the boat around when you're out of torpedoes and going back at it. Right. When Alpha went back out on 6-7 July. And it makes me a proud former Marine to read that stuff. I love listening to that stuff. And it's such an important part of our history that not many people know or understand.
Yeah. And to back up what Timmy said, when you hear Ray Linebaugh talk about trying to, you know, this NVA soldier with Marine utilities on, helmet, flak jacket, is they're waving at each other like thumbs up and stuff like that. Hey, I'm over here. And all of a sudden, another NVA soldier that's in an NVA uniform walks out next to him. And Ray said, still, the hardest thing I did in Vietnam was pull the trigger with somebody wearing that uniform.
I bet. Right? I wouldn't want to do it.
Right. And he said that. Jeff, thoughts on Operation Buffalo?
Yeah, you know, this triggers memories with us guys talking, you know. When I got out of the hospital, they made us wounded guys – who came back to the MEF, go to this interviews, like where we had presentations, and they were all guys from Alpha 1-9. And they all, and I'll tell you what, I didn't remember that until listening to this stuff. And some of them, there's like four of them, you know, and they mentioned Captain Slater, you know, who was the CO. And, I remember they were, I'm thinking, we didn't go through shit compared to these fucking guys, you know? And, you know, most of the guys that were there ran over IEDs and ended up in the hospital, you know? And so, but these guys were like, you know, it was intense and close. And that stuff with the NVA uniforms. I remember when I first, I met Leon Burns when I first went to 29 Palms in 1975. He was the platoon sergeant as a gunny for the nuclear ordnance platoon, a security platoon that, you know, that watched the nuclear ordnance. We basically had nuclear tipped 8-inch rounds in those days. And, they had special guard. And, but he was talking about, they had a intel warrant officers going up there. And the reason they went up there was to look at the dead bodies to try and verify if they were Chinese or not. And, I didn't think of that until, you know, hearing it again, you know what I mean? Those two incidents, I'll tell you that I remember being in there, you're supposed to talk about your feelings and stuff, but I'm like, so hey, tell me about, did you guys know Leon Burns? How about Lieutenant Colonel Schenning? He sucked, you know, and all this stuff, or he wasn't that bad, you know, the guy says, you know, they're going through the whole 1-9, you know, thing, because I'm not really worried about me. I'm thinking, oh my God, these guys are... You know, because when I was a young Marine, I would go to the library and get those Marines in Vietnam 1966. Marines in Vietnam 1967, that's where you fucking really, I read about it the first time. you know, Operation Buffalo. And you know, those Marine, you know, those U.S. Marine official histories about Vietnam were very good, you know. And but that's the first time you saw it. And this guy Leon Burns, you know, he was. If you talk to Gunnar Galinas, he's got a million Leon Burns stories, you know.
Yeah,
mostly liberal incident type stories. Yeah, you know, but still, you know.
No, he was. And when you look at what Bravo Company did, he was one of the. Yeah. He was the first platoon commander for Bravo Company,
right.
And as they go north towards this area called the Marketplace, up I think it's Route 571. Third platoon's in the lead, followed by second platoon. You got the mortars and machine guns moving, you know, with both of those lead platoons, and first platoon with at the time Staff Sergeant Burns is
right.
down by the trace. They were
right.
and I can't remember, something delayed them or they had to link up with somebody, and then he winds up, you know, as a company commander after everybody
they're surrounded, pinned down, right?
Right. And the other things that, you know, that I heard that I'd never heard before is, you know, the North Vietnamese use of flamethrowers.
Yes.
And one of the things that you're gonna hear in the next episode, and you know, Ray was talking about, is that the North Vietnamese built bamboo bridges
right.
across the Ben Hai River. But they were just like steps. And he
just
said,
under the surface.
Just
right.
under the surface. And he said, we watched them and it looked like they were walking on the water.
And
you had to step on the steps, and these things were anchored in the floor of the river. And that's how they got it. We wondered how they got across the river, and then we watched it, and we were like, "Holy shit! They just sent a whole battalion over the river in minutes,
right?
Right? And you couldn't see it, and so it's, you know, and the other thing he says, and which is a tribute to the NVA and them as fighters, right? And
right.
he said we had a black guy, and you know, and in the interview, you know, Ray uses the term, you know, he doesn't call him anything but gooks, right?
Gooks, right.
Right. And so so then he starts talking about, you know, Charlie, and he said, but we had a black, I think it's a sergeant, and he said, we don't call him Charlie here. We call him Mr. Charles.
Right.
Right. And he said, and that was a sign of respect because, you know, look, these guys came with artillery, with mortars, with machine guns, with flamethrowers, right, to put your head on a stick.
Yeah.
And he said, we had incredible, you know, respect for them as fighters because they, you know, they would come and they would bring it. And so it really is. It really is. And so that's why, and to me, the significance of these interviews is you say you want to fight a peer. And so with Alpha Company, they try to get the Bravo Company. They can't get there. But guess what? They had the stand to all night. They had the fight the next day because the NVA were going to come and annihilate them. And
yeah.
they knew it. So it's not like, oh, you know, Bravo Company gets whacked and then we lick our wounds. No, you got to fight the next day. And so
yeah.
to me, you say, you know, you want to study what it is to fight a peer. I mean, this stuff is amazing yeah. to listen to.
It's funny. And the connections, like there's 81's FO for 1-9 who got the Navy Cross. He became an officer. He's one of the company commanders in that fucked up operation on Koh Tang Island. And
oh, no shit.
Yeah, and they get all mixed up. It's not Captain Davis, but it's the guy who's the company commander for the other bunch. So they decide they're going to try and pull the fuck out of there. And one of the fuck-ups was, because the two companies were intermixed, it was Simmons' job to dry up the LZ and everything, and they're using those Army, you know, pave or the Air Force 53 mics, you know? And and flying right out there, a lot of them just went to the destroyer there, the Hulk, you know?
Right.
But this guy got on board the helicopter and they never knew who from his company was there and who wasn't. And so they left three machine gunners from his company there.
Right.
And those are the guys who got left. And, you know, it's just, it's kind of like the story about Jimmy Howard's Hill. You know, the guy who made him stay there, he was probably ordered to make him stay there. The company commander later was the Mao commander for the Beirut bombing of 1/8 BLT.
Right.
You know, it's like a tragedy that, you know, the irony of the fate of the thing comes back, you know.
Right. It seems to. Yeah. No, yeah. That lieutenant, he leads, right, that tank platoon that goes out there along with guys, I think, from Delta Company and some other, you know, stragglers that they put together as a QRF. And right. And one of the problems is every radio that's with Bravo Company is destroyed within the first, you know,
right.
within the first action of the fight. The company commander's killed, the FO, the FAC, everybody's dead. So they can hear it. The only reports they're getting is from Alpha Company, nothing from Bravo Company. So they
yeah,
don't.
And Burns pulled everybody together that was left, yeah.
You know what else is interesting about those interviews, Mac, is both Daryl and Ray, they're draftees.
Right.
Ray said he wanted to go in the Marine Corps, but he essentially didn't do anything till he was drafted. Draftees, 1967, which wasn't a banner year for bringing in great draftees, come into the Marine Corps, and these guys are to this day still connected to 1-9, still important, still involved in the lives of their fellow Marines. There's something there about how we used to do things that I fear we'll lose as I look at the future plans for the Marine Corps and how we're going to get super grunts that are older and more educated.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, because if you look at Vietnam in 1967 and you look at the Marine Corps in 1944 and you look at the Marine Corps in 1950, when push comes to shove, you may want to have your fucking boutique Marines who got a year and a half of training behind them before they hit the fleet. But that's just not reality. You need guys, and you need them now, you know, a lot of times. And, you know, the truth about it is we wouldn't have had Audie Murphy. We wouldn't have had fucking a lot of, you know, a lot of those guys who saved people's lives in Peleliu and so forth if we didn't have 17-year-olds coming in.
Yeah. The other thing that I've learned in general about Vietnam that I did not know is – how young they were. It's compared to the way we were in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you had corporals, you had sergeants, you had staff NCOs, right? You know, Ray is a squad leader, is a Lance Corporal.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, he's got, you know, he's got less than 24 months, you know, time in service, and he's a squad leader in Vietnam. In fact, it was interesting when I asked him about going there by yourself. Some units with the fucking new guys, right? Day one, you're out there on point, right? Good luck, right? And he said, we didn't do that. I had a sergeant, and I wish I could remember the guy's name. He was killed in action in Vietnam, you know, with Alpha Company 1-9. And he said, you know, he took care of me. From the day I got there, he took care of me. And, you know, I went out there and I learned. And then it was a while, and then I finally – when they knew I was ready, I went out and I walked point and I started taking my turn. But he took care of every one of us. And he said, and I never did that to anybody. He said, because it wasn't right. It wasn't fair. And he said, you had to teach them because they didn't know. You know, you come from, you know, the infantry training regiment at Camp Pendleton, you know, where they do their best. But it's not like Vietnam, for God's sakes. You just don't know. And he said, you know, then he started talking about bouncing Bettys. And he's talking about Bernard Fall. I didn't know this. Bernard Fall.
Yeah, Bernard Fall got killed by
I did.
Guy who wrote Street Without Joy. He got killed by a bouncing Betty. That's right.
Up with 1-9.
Without
yep.
for
yes,
one
exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so
you found another street without joy. And he died on it.
And so it's real interesting, you know, to hear that. And but just how young we were in Vietnam. And I go back. Timmy's, you know, talks about, you know, a lot of times because he's lived with it. You know, the prosecution of the war from a personnel standpoint, how we did it. Where the fuck was everybody?
Yeah.
I mean, were they on recruiting duty? What were they doing? Where you have so many 17, 18, 19-year-old young, you know, men, you know, young men who are novices in the military, and they're in all these positions. And now I'm curious about somebody explain to me who the fuck this made sense to.
You're right. Well, here's who it made sense to: the guys who were afraid of drafting college kids. Because let me tell you, we went from the greatest generation and did the Depression, World War II, to the most broke dick generation, the ones who dodged Vietnam and let a bunch of teenagers fight it. And three of our presidents were those guys, you know, you know, exactly right. They had better fucking things to do. And these young kids and these professionals went and tried to do it. And it's amazing they did as good as they did when you look at it that way.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it's got to have something to do with the individual replacement system. Because if they were sending over full battalions, they wouldn't be sending them over with Lance Corporal squad leaders. So somehow that system sort of broke things. Because I remember my dad and Uncle Chad talking about this when I was a young child, about how we've got to have staff NCOs over there. That was one of the things that was a big topic in the Marine Corps Gazette, I believe, back then. Where the hell are all our NCOs and staff NCOs? And where they were in B billets, because the Marine Corps was growing and throwing in 17-year-olds, but they still had to man all their obligations and detachments around the world, and they're not going to put a 17-year-old draftee on an aircraft carrier with a Lieutenant McNamara guarding nukes.
They made them officers, like fucking like Lovingood,
West Fox.
West Fox. Yep. There's another guy named Roweller that was one of those tough guys.
Bathurst.
Fragged to death.
Bathurst.
You know.
Bathurst. Well, yeah, Bathurst. Really he doesn't tough. Become an officer until he comes back to the States. But I mean, it is amazing. And so it's like, okay, it's not like, I mean, the guys who made those policies had been through World War II and been through Korea. And now they're working the Vietnam problem. It's not like they didn't know.
Mac, you're forgetting the former head of Ford Motor Company.
Oh, fuck.
Who he decided, no, I know better. We're going to have this thing called a trace that's going to keep the enemy out with its sensors and its plowed ground and shit. Oh, and by the way, we're going to have this new thing where everybody does about a year or so, you know, and this way it's fair, and, you know, we'll always have fresh troops. And what about cohesion? Oh, that's just an old wives' tale.
Yeah.
You know? And so everything, and these guys just got shut down. And that's what I think is the more of an impetus than the fact that the war wasn't going good. It could have gone better. I mean, Harold Johnson, like, you know, you brought up many times on this podcast, these guys, they decided, you know, I can do more working to better things from the inside. Whereas if they all fucking said, fuck you guys, you want to listen to fucking McNamara and this dildos who work for him, go ahead. And if they had walked out then, you know, I don't know what Johnson would have done. But, you know, I just don't know. You know, I mean, it's a what if thing, but it couldn't have gotten any worse.
No.
That's for sure.
No, impossible for it to get worse. The more that, you know, I do these things about Vietnam, I you hear stuff. That's not the first time I think Daryl Horn somewhere in that interview says that they killed Chinese too.
Right.
And, you know, and I remember Tim's dad, I think, mentioning that as well.
Right.
And so, you know, you hear that and you're like, you know, we could tell they were bigger. I mean, they were different, right? And physically, you could tell they looked different. And so, no, to me, it's just to hear. And in the interview that ran yesterday with Ray, right? I mean, to hear his pride and you know, I call it the general question at the end. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that, you know, without which this interview isn't complete? And it came from. I asked that interviewing guys. I had to write a paper when I was as a captain. I'd just come from teaching at IOC, and I went to the advanced armor course. And you had to write something about a battle, armor in World War II. So I wrote about armor on Iwo Jima. And I got a list from, I want to say, the Marine Corps Association of Living Tankers. They sent me a list. And so I started looking them up, and I get their phone numbers, and I would call them, and I introduced myself, and I'd say, "Would you mind talking about the battle?" And every one of them that I called said, "I don't talk about it, but I'll talk to a Marine about it." And I said, "Okay." And one of the best response, and why I always continue to ask that, was this: I'd ask it, and they'd tell me shit. So I'd say, "What's the one thing about the battle you'll never forget?" And one guy told me, "The first thing I ever saw in Iwo Jima was a guy with his boots on the back tire of a Jeep, holding on to the side rail, taking a shit." And I, right? And he said, "That's what, when I think of Iwo Jima, that's the first thing that picture in my head." And then this one guy I asked, and he said, you know, what's the one thing if I don't include in this, it won't be complete. And he said, how tough the Japanese were. He said, you know, they were hellacious fighters. He said, but on Iwo Jima, they had a smart guy in charge, and it was brutal. The fighting was absolutely brutal. And so then, you know, I thanked him, and I started to, you know, get off the phone. And he says, hey, Mac, one more thing. And I said, yeah. And he said, remember how tough I told you they were? And I said, yeah. He said, we kicked their fucking asses right off that island. and I
that's awesome.
I loved that. I mean, now this guy was probably in his, at the time, in 1992, 1993, he was probably in his, you know, in his 70s. But there was still that fuck you pride of being a Marine, yeah, and that toughness that, and I laughed just like you guys just did. Hey, one other thing. Remember how tough I told you? We kicked their fucking asses right off that island. And and so when I asked Ray, he started talking about your training. And he said, you know, when those drill instructors are in your face and you hate their guts, just know this. There's a reason for that. And the reason is that it works under pressure. Right. And he said, trust your training, trust your training, trust your training. And those interviews they're unbelievable. And yeah, the cool part is that they keep leading to other interviews. Yeah. Right. And really that sequence starts with Tim's dad and Tim's uncle. You know, the fighting around Leatherneck Square and, you know, LZ Margo.
Yeah, LZ Margo. I remember Tim's dad talking about that.
Right.
Do an article on it.
Right. And then he came on and he talked about it. And so to me, you know, as you broaden the lens, it just seems like there's a lot of stupid shit that got done in Vietnam, you know, and guys following orders. You know, and Tim's dad's a perfect example. You know, he gets told because an arc light's going in, right? And they won't tell him that. But he's got to bring the whole battalion that's under observation of the North Vietnamese, right, back to an LZ. It's a stupid fucking order.
Yeah.
And he pushes
in the high ground in the process.
And he pushes back, right? And he gets told to shut up in fucking color. And exactly what General Lynch tells them is going to happen, Major Lynch at the time, happens. They pull the battalion back, and they get the shit mortared out of them, and they medevac what, Timmy, 150 guys?
Jeez. Yeah, 150. He still doesn't – I don't believe he knows to this day the true KIA versus WIA numbers. I mean, it was that fucking bad.
And the article, the title of his article is The Dead Went Last.
Yeah, the dead were the last to go.
Right, and so –
because they're routine medevacs.
Right. And so you – I'll never forget his description of last 46, I think, that takes off. And it takes off, and it's overloaded and because the 46 pilot said throw them all on. And, right. And when he takes off, they head down into a canyon, and they're just like, oh, fuck, no, this thing's going to go down, you know, and now we're going to have to go down there and do that. And he said he pulled it up and it got over the mountain. They were like, fuck, thank fucking God. He didn't say the F word. I threw that in there. But no, it just seems like there's a lot of that shit. And the same thing with, you know, with the interviews relative to Gitlin's Corner. You know, that company commander pushes back. Go stick, you know, go put in three platoon ambushes, reinforce platoon ambushes. Hey, there's a lot of guys up here. You know.
This is regiment online time, not fuck around in the Quang Nam province time.
Right, and then after he pushes back and he gets told, look, we'll send another captain out there to take over the company to do it, right? Then the lieutenants are with him and they're talking. They're like, hey, sir, we can just send them, right, grid coordinates. They're not going to fucking know.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Right, and Gitlin says, we're not going to do that.
Right. If that's what they want. If you do that shit, the men will do it to you later on.
Right. And so,
that's right. You can't do it.
And so, you know, he does what they told. But it's like, I mean, now that would never happen. If the company commander called you and said that to you, you'd say, got it. You're out there. You do what you think is best. Right. You can debrief it when you get back. You would never say, hey, Captain, I fucking told you, blah, blah, blah. I mean, anybody worth their salt wouldn't do it.
Right.
But it just seems like there's so much of that that leads to so much death that, I mean, it's just discouraging. You know, I mean, it's just discouraging.
Yet there's young guys who are drafted into the suck, went over there, sucked that all up, and came out the other end. Fantastic, you know, Marines, former Marines. I'm amazed. Yeah. Because it's not a big surprise with you and I or Jeff. We're kind of we're predisposed to this type of stuff. But for guys that were drafted in and to come out the other end of that horrible steering experience, feeling nothing but love for the Corps and what they did for him, that's amazing.
Yeah, but Timmy, I mean, we all know there's a lot of guys who didn't make it when they came home, right? Drank themselves to death, drugs and all the rest of it, and because the way they got treated, you know, and that's awful young to go through that experience.
Yeah.
And I remember, in fact, at the end, if you want to watch something really interesting, go to the Ken and Betty Rogers documentary, right, Caisson Bravo, right, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. And it's a story of Bravo Company 126 at Caisson. Watch the last 10 minutes of it and watch them talk about coming home from Vietnam. And one of those, I mean, they're sitting there and they all get emotional. And one of the guys looks at the cameras and says, I just wanted my country to love me as much as I loved it.
Right.
And I found out that it didn't. And it broke my heart. And you're like, oh, fuck, you know, and again, and these guys were 18, 19 when they came home. They were 17, 18 when they went.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rough shit, man, for being that young and then to be shit on by your country. So, it's fascinating, fascinating stuff. But again, to echo what Jeff said, you know, what comes through in spades is the toughness that has always been part of the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And how important that is, and how important that toughness is. Because let me tell you, if we think we're going to go fight the Chinese and they're going away anytime soon because we have more missiles than they are, bullshit, boys. Yeah. Bullshit. Exactly. And what we've seen in the last two wars we fought in is they won't quit. And how do we react when they won't quit?
Yeah, the one thing these guys all sell themselves on is the softness of the average American.
Right.
And if we just go, if they go high tech, we go no tech.
Right.
And they're convinced they can win that way, and they're wrong. As long as we
Japanese thought that too.
Right.
Well, but again, as long as you play by the Marcus Queensberry's rules, we're good.
Yeah.
It's when, you know, as Jeff said, you go no tech. Okay, we exhaust our cruise missiles. We shoot all the fucking hypersonic missiles. And now there's a lot of dead people on both sides. Now what the fuck's going to happen?
Right.
Who's going to tighten their belt and set their jaw and say, okay, you're right? And I mean, and I heard, you know, Ray will talk about it, you know, here in the command, and Timmy talked about it a couple weeks ago, fixed bayonets. Like what?
Yeah. Snick.
we're gonna fight for our lives, boys. Get ready.
Hey man, and I would contend to you, and my dad made reference to this once when I was growing up. I'm not so sure it's true, but he says in China there's a museum set up dedicated to United States Marines that the Chinese Communist forces knew very well, which was obvious if you study the war at 1952 time frame. They would go out of their way to avoid hitting Marine battalions because they didn't want to get their asses chewed up. The North Vietnamese, remember that blonde-haired soldier that wrote the books afterwards?
Yeah.
He was in Northern I Corps. He's like the only survivor from his regiment, you know.
Right.
The people that we faced off against, Mr. Charles was good. The Japanese were good. The Chinese in Korea, not so much, but there's a lot of them. And we always stood our ground. We never, ever backed down from those guys. And that's a reputation that we enjoy that other adversaries are well aware of. And I wonder how the Chinese view our potential change in our force structure and removing the very elements that make us that offensive, ferocious a beast, that combined arms beast.
That closed with organization.
Because that is a big relief to them. The one thing I don't think that anybody ever wants to do in any kind of a fair manner is his tango with a Marine Corps combat outfit, battalion size, even company size. Shit, these days it doesn't matter. You don't want to do it because you're going to get hurt. You know, and that's when I think about the changes in the future, I think about the past and what we did to earn that reputation, because it's well deserved. I mean, it's earned.
And I don't know, when I look at, you know, the wars we fought, and you know, you get past the first act of it, right? And then what? You know, did we think they were going to quit? Because nobody's quit yet. It's, you know, it's the folly of, you know, the drone missile strike on XYZ leader of XYZ organization. It's irrelevant. It's the body count, right?
Yeah.
They're not quitting. Well, wait a minute. That wasn't in the story, right?
That brings up a great point about complementarism. And that's something I think that our general officers aren't very adept at teaching our civilian leadership, that all of us work best when we complement each other. The whole reason the special forces can exist and be effective is because there's a conventional force that they complement. And in trying to avoid one, you're going to run afoul with the other one. That's just basic. That's the basicness of the, you know, that's the Navy Marine Corps team. That's the Army and the Air Force. That's special ops and conventional ops, you know?
Interesting. Yeah. Yes. And all that stuff, I mean, comes out as you just rotate the kaleidoscope on these issues that, you know, that you see, you know, coming out of Vietnam. But some of the stuff is fascinating. And the whole low-tech thing, like, you know, to hear him. So we kind of restricted the discussion to July 2nd, 1967, and Operation Buffalo. And then when you hear Ray talk about July 6, 7, and you hear his voice when he describes this footbridge, right? I mean, it's amazing. Like, we always wondered, like, you know, how are they getting across the Benhai River, right? And then he tells you this, like, this low-tech, right, thing.
Yeah.
This low-tech thing. And then the other things that, you know, he talks about is the heat. And he talks about a black Marine, a machine gunner, playing dead, and they went, and when they went to pick up his body, he jumped up because he realized it was Marines, and he said, you know, his face, he said, black guys, when they die, you know, their face kind of gets this chalky color, and he said he jumped up and he was laughing and crying because they were shooting guys and they shot him and they thought they hit him and they missed. And then they took his canteens and he was dying of thirst. And he said, because, you know, it was so fucking hot up there.
And
he said he laid there and played dead while they drank his water. And he said every bone in his body was screaming like, oh my God, no, they're drinking my water. And, you know, and you realize the elements that they fought there, the artillery that they lived under every day. And let me tell you, man, it is, you know, that kind of, you want, that's why these things are so incredible. You want to understand what it is to fight a peer. Listen to these guys tell these stories. And it's amazing. The guy who adjusts the artillery, and I think it was in that thing I sent you guys, right? You know, BFO is a PFC for July 6, 7. He's a PFC adjusting groups of artillery in you know, danger close. And it's just, I mean, it is a little bit head-scratching at times, but it's amazing, and it makes you really proud to be a Marine. So
anyway. Matt Kidd must have had some mad math skills.
Oh, my God. You pray to God.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, once you get the first mission down, then it's all adjustment, and it's like. But you're right. That's like
he's a PFC.
These
right?
guys are as good at math as I am.
he's a fucking PFC though. Hey, are you good at this? I think so, sir. All right, get on it. It's you. I've got other shit I got to do.
Carry the base plate and the mortar.
Exactly. All right. Final thoughts, Timmy.
Well, brother, I think we're going to end up coming out of this COVID-19 thing rather spontaneously by popular decree. And we'll see where the fallout goes. But I don't know, man. I am very positive about our future as a country coming out of this thing, because I don't think we're going to tolerate extended lockdowns that are being advised by certain members of certain political parties. So I'm feeling good, brother. I'm feeling good. I think we're going to have NCAA football this fall. I honestly do.
Oh, I think, yeah, I think without a doubt.
Yeah, that's good enough for me.
All right, Jeff.
Yeah, I think there's going to be more civil unrest regarding the overreach, you know, and the basically tromping on a lot of the Bill of Rights amendments that happened during this thing, almost gleefully by the people who did it. And I think there'll be a backlash, and I think you know, that'll lead to a better country.
Inshallah.
Honestly, I'm surprised that woman's still in jail.
Yeah,
I believe she is. I don't think I've been looking. I haven't seen her get out. The governor and the state attorney general have been demanding she be released, but yeah, that has not got her free.
The deputy governor, Deval Patrick, or no, what's his name? I can't remember his name. You know it, Timmy. But this guy paid her fine already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's right. As a matter of fact, I'm just looking at that right here. Luther. Oh, that's her name is Luther. Doesn't say his name, but yeah. Yeah, her fine's been paid. I think she's got a GoFundMe account with $150,000, $200,000 already stocking up in it. I just hope it was started by somebody affiliated with her and she gets the money, because you know how that sometimes works out with that.
Yeah. So anyway, it's like we're coming. It's another stress point, you know?
Yeah,
it's gonna come to a head in November.
It's amazing, you know, especially in a state like Texas.
Yep.
Right.
Oh, hey man, this place has got pockets of deep blue. Where I live is deep blue. Austin, Houston, and parts of Dallas. Very, very heavily Democrat. Almost exclusively Democrat.
Interesting. Yeah. All right, boys. As always, enjoyed the conversation. Have a good week, and I'll talk to you next week.
Right here.
All right. Bye, guys. More of Allmarine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.